Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to a podcast from the Center for Emerging Media. On Thursday, March 20th, it will have been 5 years since the United States invaded Iraq. The stated objective? Well, on March 22nd, 2003, President Bush said, quote, "Our mission is clear, to disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, to end Saddam Hussein's support for terrorism, and to free the Iraqi people," end quote. The weapons of mass destruction were never found. And in 2005, the Iraq Study Group determined that no weapons of mass destruction were in Iraq at the time of the invasion. Saddam Hussein was found and executed. The Iraqi people were able to participate in elections with a high turnout, but have over the past 5 years been living in a violent country where neighborhoods are deeply divided along ethnic lines, where the population has dropped dramatically as Iraqis flee, choosing refugee camps over remaining in a country where, according to the website iraqbodycount.org, an average of 64 Iraqi civilians were killed each day during 2007. Almost 4,000 American troops have been killed. And though we won't know the exact number for some time to come, there are tens of thousands who come home with severe physical and mental disabilities. But somehow, as we approach the fifth anniversary of this war, the headlines seem to have moved into other topics. Whereas it was once assumed that the 2008 presidential elections would focus on Iraq, the extremely competitive race between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama seems to have instead had the effect of pushing Iraq onto the back burner. Instead of talking about Iraq, we're talking about superdelegates and redoing the primaries in Florida and Michigan. So in this podcast, we're going to talk about Iraq and the presidential election. What would Senators McCain, Clinton, and Obama do about Iraq if they were elected? We're going to go beyond what they say and look at who their advisors are and what that can tell us about their true intentions. We'll look at how they've approached the war in the past and what can be expected from each of them in the future. We're going to talk with Brad Simpson, who is professor of history at UMBC, and get his perspective on Iraq and the 2008 presidential elections. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm sitting across the table from Brad Simpson, who's assistant professor of history at UMBC and director of the Indonesia and East Timor Documentation Project. Brad has spent a lot of time in Iraq and has appeared with me many times talking about Iraq and what's going on there politically in America when it comes to Iraq. And Brad, good to talk to you again. Let's talk a bit about your perception of the presidential candidates and where they are with this race. But first, it seems that Iraq, for many people, maybe because of the surge, maybe because of the economy, maybe because of how the press is reporting it around the country, a combination of those things, is fallen off. It has not become the primary issue in America's mind. So I wonder what role you think it still plays in this presidential election.
Well, I think that this is largely a response to the complete abandonment by the mainstream press of any sustained serious reporting about not only what's happening in Iraq and the sort of underlying social and economic conditions in Iraq in the aftermath of the so-called success of the so-called surge, but it's also a reflection of the limits of American politics in 2007 and 2008 and the unwillingness of the Democratic Party to make Iraq a central issue in the presidential campaign, because they fear that if the media and the Republicans can create the impression that the surge has in fact succeeded, that Iraq won't be a winning political issue. And I think the political discussions aside, and we can talk about the positions of the candidates,
right,
about Clinton and Obama and McCain, I think that the vast majority of the Democratic establishment belongs very firmly in the liberal hawks camp, believing that if the war is succeeding, that it's impolitic to criticize it, but if the war seems to be going bad, that there's political traction to be gained by criticizing the president. And I believe that most of the Democratic Party would be willing to accept the war if they thought that it could be successful. The debate within the Democratic and Republican Party is not about the principled matter of whether or not the United States was committing the crime of aggression by invading Iraq in the first place. It's not a principled debate about whether or not the United States has the right to demolish an entire society and uproot its people and smash its infrastructure in the name of American interests. The question is largely, can we succeed or not? And the debate within Democratic and Republican circles largely is confined between those on the right who believe that, yes, we are succeeding, and yes, we have the right to engage in these kinds of military actions regardless of whether we succeed or fail, and those on the liberal left who argue that we also have the right to invade and occupy countries such as Iraq, but only if we can be successful. And we can compare this sort of debate to what was happening around Vietnam in the late 60s, where you had many liberal hawks who were just as eager as their Republican counterparts to invade and occupy Vietnam. Only turned against the war when it became clear that the United States couldn't achieve its goals at an acceptable cost to us.
And who do you think are the liberal hawks? Who are you labeling as liberal hawks in the Democratic Party today? Who comes to mind?
Well, Hillary Clinton is first and foremost. And most of the Democratic Party establishment, you can look at the man who is sort of lurking in the wings as the likely Secretary of State in the Hillary Clinton administration, Richard Holbrooke, who is a former U.N. ambassador. During the Carter administration, he was the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs. He was probably the leading official in the 1970s, along with Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Carter's national security advisor, seeking to undermine those officials within the Carter administration who were pressing for the Carter administration to make a more principled stance in favor of human rights, to condition U.S. military and economic assistance to countries on the basis of whether or not they're murdering or torturing their citizens. And Richard Holbrooke was among a small group of high-level officials, along with Zbigniew Brzezinski, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, who believed that human rights really shouldn't play any sort of great role in shaping American foreign policy. And during the Clinton administration, Holbrooke was among the chief hawks advocating military strikes against Yugoslavia. He was a firm supporter of the genocidal sanctions against Iraq that killed hundreds of thousands of people, supported the 1998 bombing of Iraq, Operation Desert Fox, supported the military intervention in Haiti, the bombing of Sudan in 1998. And most of the officials surrounding Hillary Clinton, former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, are very firmly in the what some would call the sort of muscular liberal sort of wing of the Democratic Party, believing that the United States still has the right and the obligation to exercise a dominant military position in the world, that the United States still has the right to intervene wherever and whenever we choose, but that we should try and exhaust multilateral possibilities first before we resort to the unilateral option.
But most people you've mentioned in this liberal hawk wing, as you put it, the people who you say are around Hillary Clinton's campaign, I mean, they opposed the war from the beginning. These were not people who were hawkish and for the war.
Most of these supported the war from the beginning. In fact, all of Hillary Clinton's major foreign policy advisors did support the war and continued to support the war until it became clear that the war was an unmitigated disaster for the Iraqis, far more so than say, Barack Obama supporters. And I'm not a fan of either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, but I think we can learn a lot by looking at the people surrounding them and the range of the sort of foreign policy ideas that these people have advocated. And the foreign policy advisors surrounding Hillary Clinton are very much in the sort of hawkish wing of the Democratic Party.
So what's the essential difference for you then between staying with the Democrats for a moment before we move over to Senator McCain, between the policy advisors that surround Hillary Clinton, who you've just described, and the policy advisors that are surrounding Barack Obama?
If you look at the advisors surrounding Barack Obama, they include people such as Joseph Cirincione, who is the head of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Lawrence Korb of the Center for American Progress, Samantha Power, who is recently sacked by the campaign, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who wrote a very important book called A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. Samantha Powers was a blistering critic of the Clinton administration's efforts at the United Nations to block the UN Security Council from intervening to halt the Rwandan genocide.
And she had to leave the campaign because she made comments about Hillary Clinton that were found distasteful.
Yes. Right? And between the three of these folks, we can see certainly a much wider scope of opinion than exists within the Clinton campaign. But both Korb and Samantha Powers and Siren Sione are people who take seriously the proposition that the United States needs to embed itself in multilateral institutions, that the United States does not have the right unilaterally to invade, occupy, bomb any country it wishes, which is the basic position of the Hillary Clinton campaign. They are all opposed to and would actually seek to roll back the vast expansion of executive power that we've witnessed under the Bush administration. All of them support a fairly rapid withdrawal from Iraq of, at the very least, combat troops. And in this regard, all three candidates are extremist with regards to the positions expressed by the American public, you know, almost two-thirds of whom support a total withdrawal of all U.S. troops within a year to 18 months. And none of the three candidates are advocating positions that come anywhere near or close to that. But given the three major candidates, Barack Obama's advisors are far more open to the sort of ideas and pressures of grassroots movements against the war, as well as more appreciative of the human cost of the war, of the ruin that the war has visited upon Iraqi society. These are folks who in their academic writings have expressed far more appreciation of the need for a more democratic globalization of the economy and not simply a neoliberal model of market-driven privatization, which is largely shared by both John McCain as well as Hillary Clinton and her advisors. So there are substantial differences. And at a moment in time when the exercise of U.S. power in the world can literally mean the difference between life and death for millions of people, those margins are important because they often represent the difference between enormous suffering and people literally living or dying.
So going on to Senator McCain and his position on the war, as you and I speak at this moment, he is in Iraq. He supports the surge and supports a policy that leaves us in Iraq for some time to come until, as he puts it, that we have the job done.
Yeah, John McCain's views, or the people surrounding John McCain, are in a lot of ways really frightening. Among the most extreme of the sort of far right neoconservatives surrounding President Bush and Vice President Cheney, people such as William Kristol of the Weekly Standard, Robert Kagan and Fred Kagan, who are two of the authors of the surge that President Bush put in place a year ago, Max Boot, who's a far right scholar and commentator, who wrote a book called The Savage Wars of Peace, in which he argued that the U.S. counterinsurgency war in the Philippines, in which the United States employed concentration camps, torture, killed.
We're talking about the early 20th century,
yeah,
after the Spanish-American War.
Right? Yeah, that this war in which somewhere between a quarter of a million and three quarters of a million Filipinos were massacred or starved, where waterboarding was used and concentration camps
were began, really.
Yeah, that this provides a model for the kinds of counterinsurgency wars that the U.S. should be waging around the world. These are the folks that are surrounding McCain. And if you look at his positions and the sorts of proposals that these folks have put forth, they represent a belief in unadorned, unalloyed militarism, in preemption, in unilateralism, in a greatly expanded covert operations and covert action capacity. All of them would seek to undermine the United Nations, to expand NATO and use it as a sort of intervention force for the so-called democratic powers of the West. McCain's advisors have proposed creating a League of Democracies, which could serve to gather outside of the framework of the United Nations Security Council those countries allied with the United States who believe in American-led military action around the world to engage in regime change to overthrow or invade countries that allegedly threaten American interests. One of McCain's more centrist critics, a man named Ivo Dalton, who is a scholar at the Brookings Institution, has said that there literally is no country on earth that Senator McCain does not believe we have the right to bomb or invade. Lawrence Wilkerson, General Colin Powell's former chief advisor, has said that John McCain's positions are truly frightening. And even given the dramatic shift to the right that is represented by the current Bush administration, John McCain would likely bring us even further to the right and would probably be the most openly militarist president in modern American history.
But wait, but let me just stop here for a moment. I mean, one of the things that and by the way, we're talking with Brad Simpson, who's assistant professor of history at UMBC, who has been involved both theoretically and practically in Iraq and has visited there many times. And John McCain is seen by, I think, most of the press, and I dare to say most of the American people, as the reasonable candidate for people who are considering to vote for Republican, who have trying to wrestle with who they want to vote for, whether it's Democrat or Republican, and that one would have a more moderating influence on his foreign policy than President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. And you're saying something quite different here.
Yeah, McClatchy Newspapers, a Christian Science Monitor, Robert Dreyfuss recently came out with a piece on this in The Nation, all of whom are arguing that from Russia to China to Iran to North Korea to Iraq, that John McCain is in fact far more hawkish than President Bush, far more committed as a matter of principle, first and foremost to the use of American military power to affect change in the world than President Bush was. John McCain is a true believer, and there are a few conflicts in the world today that John McCain has not taken a more hawkish position on than certainly than Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, but even than George Bush, from arguing that Russia should be expelled from the G8, that the U.S. should take a more confrontational stance over China and North Korea. He has said repeatedly that he believes that military action and likely war will be the only way to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, and that the United States should in fact be prepared to go to war against Iran, even though, as the most recent national intelligence estimate has concluded, Iran has no nuclear weapons program and has not had one for several years. And yet, time and time again, McCain has made it clear that he is more committed to military action, more committed to unilateralism, more committed to the unrivaled, unrestrained use of American military power.
So Senator Obama or Senator Clinton or Senator McCain will be the next president of the United States. One of those three people will in fact be the next president if something else happens, which we all doubt. So what do you think will be the Iraq policies? What do you think, very quick, briefly, look at all three candidates. What do you think will happen in Iraq with our Iraq policy under each person, starting with Senator Clinton, going to Senator Obama, and ending with Senator McCain?
Well, Senator Clinton's position is that 60 days after her inauguration, she would begin the partial withdrawal of American troops. She has not made much more of a commitment than that. It is very clear she has not called for, nor do any of her advisors suggest that she would be prepared to withdraw all combat troops from Iraq, which means that one could expect, at the very least, that somewhere between 70 and 100,000 American troops would remain in Iraq for the foreseeable future. She has said that she rules out withdrawing all troops or would not commit to withdrawing even all combat troops before a first term was ended. It puts her sort of in the middle. Senator Barack Obama has said that he would immediately begin the withdrawal of all American combat troops. But once one takes into account support troops, those who would be guarding the mammoth U.S. embassy, the largest embassy of any country in the history of the world, currently clocking in at $1 billion and counting for construction costs, once one includes corruption, overruns, and the like, Barack Obama has suggested that the United States would still need to maintain tens of thousands of troops in Iraq to train Iraqi forces, to engage in counterterrorism operations, to serve as a strike force, perhaps based immediately outside of Iraq in Kuwait or in other bases in the region. So we can likely anticipate that under a Barack Obama administration that perhaps 50 to 70,000 troops would remain in Iraq and several tens of thousands more in the region. Barack Obama, alone among the three candidates, has said that he would not rule out the use of mercenaries. There are tens of thousands of mercenaries, including from odious former security forces of South Africa, Uganda, Chile and other former right-wing regimes. And Barack Obama has said that he would continue to rely and would refuse to rule out relying on private contractors or mercenaries to carry out American foreign policy in Iraq. And in fact, on that issue, Hillary Clinton has been slightly better. John McCain has been about the same as Hillary Clinton on this, criticizing on the margins the activities of Blackwater and other mercenary guns for hire and their activities in Iraq. But realistically, under none of the candidates would we likely foresee a complete American withdrawal from Iraq, meaning that none of the three candidates have positions that are even close to the position of the American public. You know, somewhere between 55% and 65% of whom want all American troops withdrawn within the next year. Somewhere around 2/3 to 3/4 of all Iraqis want all U.S. troops withdrawn either immediately or within the next year. So the positions of the three major presidential candidates are extremist in their rejection of the overwhelming sentiment of the American public and the sentiment of the people of Iraq. But they do represent the acceptable limits of elite opinion within the Democratic and Republican Party, which has always been fairly contemptuous of the views of both the American public and has pretended as if the views of Iraqis are simply irrelevant, which for most Americans they are. But this is the sort of dovish extreme. When we get to the positions of John McCain, he has stated very unequivocally that he foresees no withdrawal of U.S. forces except as conditions allow. He has not made clear what those conditions are, other than that he will not begin withdrawing American troops until we have achieved, quote, total victory, which not even the most fantastic extremist supporters of the war have suggested that anything approaching total victory could ever be achieved, even if we could conceive of what that means. John McCain has said that he believes that the threat of so-called radical Islamic extremism is the transcendent threat of our times, far more important than, say, global warming or global poverty or the threat of nuclear proliferation or any number of other issues, which the rest of the world considers to be far more important than the activities of a rather small band of radical Muslims whose activities have nevertheless mushroomed by 700% since the United States invaded Afghanistan and Iraq in 2001. It's very likely that under John McCain, we would see a fairly straightforward continuation of the current Bush administration policies, likely no reductions of U.S. troops, and likely an escalation, if not a dramatic escalation, of U.S. military action elsewhere in the world. Moving sort of very quickly to the broader sort of U.S. military budget, all three candidates have said that the United States should either maintain or expand military spending, which right now accounts for about 60% of total global military spending. And here again, we can see that on the face of it, the positions of Obama and Clinton and McCain are dramatically at odds with the priorities of the vast majority of the American people.
Well, as you conclude here, Brad, I wonder, when you look at this presidential election, though, even though the majority of people in America oppose this war in Iraq and want to see it over, it doesn't seem to be something that intellectually or viscerally moves the American public in terms of who they're going to vote for in this election. Mm-hmm. There seem to be other things going on here, that Iraq has fallen into not the back pages so much, but it certainly does not grab the hearts and minds of the American people as much as the economy and some other issues are doing at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how much you think how important all this is in terms of what happens between now and November.
Well, I think it depends on how the candidates articulate the choices that continued war and occupation in Iraq and massive military spending actually present for the American public. Joe Stiglitz has recently come out with a book entitled The $3 Trillion War, in which he lays out in great and appalling detail the economic sacrifices that the war has imposed on this generation and future generations. And even given the administration's own figures for the current cost of the war, the United States could solve the Social Security crisis for the next 75 years, provide universal health care for all American children, and subsidize health care for everyone else in America who lacks health care. There are enormous resources that have been totally squandered by this war and that we will continue to pay for decades to come that could be put to far better use in dealing with the tremendous domestic problems that we have, collapsing infrastructure, inadequate healthcare, environmental, educational spending, any number of other things. The U.S. military budget right now is 88 times the budget for climate change, which most of the world believes is a far more pressing problem, both in the near and the long term, than continuing to wage a disastrous and globally unpopular and immoral and illegal war. And I think if the American public were allowed to put in their two cents on the matter, to articulate their professed sort of concerns and needs for adequate spending for education, for healthcare, for the environment, for job training, for fair trade, not trade that benefits corporations rather than workers and the environment, that it's clear that the war has been a total disaster in terms of the diversion of resources to war contractors, to subcontractors from Nepal or Chile or South Africa who are staffing the war, rather than dealing with the immediate and pressing needs that we face now as the economy slides into recession, as housing collapses, as education spending and other forms of social spending are collapsing. And this is money that right now is being put on our credit card, the national credit card, and being sold as debt to countries like China and other foreign investors with lots of money that could otherwise be spent on meeting human needs.
Brad Simpson, thanks so much. Learned a lot from you today. It's good to have you with us.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Brad Simpson is Assistant Professor of History at UMBC and Director of the Indonesia and East Timor Documentation Project. You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. Engineering assistance from Liz Buckle. And thanks to Clean Cuts, Music, and Sound Design for studio space. To hear more and learn more, visit us on the web at marksteinerblog.wordpress.com or just Google Mark Steiner Blog. And from the Center for Emerging Media, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.